The mother is not a shopper. She hates to shop, is generally bad at it, though she does like a good sale. She cannot stroll meaningfully through anger, denial, grief, and acceptance. She goes straight to bargaining and stays there. How much, she calls out to the ceiling, to some makeshift construction of holiness she has desperately, though not uncreatively, assembled in her mind and prayed to. A doubter, never before given to prayer. She must now reap what she has not sown. She must assemble from scratch an entire altar of worship and begging. She tries for noble abstractions, nothing too anthropomorphic, just some higher morality, though if this particular highness looks something like something like the manager at Marshall Field's sucking a frango mint, so be it. Amen. Just tell me what you want, requests the mother, and how do you want it? More charitable acts? A billion starting now. Charitable thoughts? Harder? But of course, I'll do the cooking, honey. I'll pay the rent. Just tell me. Excuse me? Well, if not to you, to whom do I speak? Hello? To whom do I have to speak around here? A higher up? A superior? Wait, I can wait. I've got all day. I've got the whole damn day.
Fluid, cracked, mordant, colloquial. Moore's sentences hold, even startle. So wrote James McManus in the New York Times Book Review some years ago about the prose of essayist, novelist, and short story writer Laurie Moore, then a professor of English at the UW-Madison, and more recently a professor at Vanderbilt University. And that description still applies today more than ever in her latest novel, I Am Homeless If This Is Not My Home. How did Laurie Moore's sharply unique style come to be, and does it rub off on the writers that she teaches? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. My guest is Laurie Moore, returning to the University of the Air after many years, and welcome back.
Well, thank you, Norman. It's great to be here.
As I read I Am Homeless If This Is Not My Home and some of your other work, including the one we just heard you read from, the canonical Babblings from Pede Onk, one of your many colorful titles, I had to wonder, did you start writing poetry as a young person?
Oh, sure. I think every teenager writes poetry. And certainly if you turn out to be in the literary business, you probably have some adolescent poetry, you know, in some boxes up in the attic.
What do you get out of writing poetry that carries forward into your work as a
I don't really think about it that way or that much, but I think at, you know, when I was younger, I just loved language that was fresh and interesting and coming in from a different place. You know, when you have your regular K through 12 education, it's not full of interesting language. And then you get to college and suddenly think, you know, if your professors are good, and most professors are good, and they give you poetry to read, and it just wakes up your mind and wakes up your heart. So,
well, it also teaches a certain kind of conciseness and the absolute necessity of picking the right word for the right place.
There's that. Yep, there's that. You can learn that also by watching stand-up comedy.
That's true.
It's true. I mean, rhythm is so key, and an extra word will ruin a funny line that a stand-up comic is uttering. So they really work on the rhythm and the economy of their language as well. So it can be learned in a number of different ways. I also worked as a paralegal after college, and I had to digest depositions, and I had to take out all this extraneous language, and so it can be learned that way too.
In a sense, self-editing.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, you stare at the sentence and you go, is this word necessary? You know, maybe I can take this out. I'm still doing that with this current book. I'm making changes for the paperback, which I hope they'll allow.
Is that kosher?
I've done it every time, but I the publishing world is changing so quickly. I don't know if they'll allow me to do it this time, but we'll see. I hope so, because I want to make some changes.
Should I ask what kind, Will?
No, just little word changes, like pulling a word out, you know, and I see little repetitions that I want to fix.
We will be getting more into I Am Homeless If This Is Not My Home a bit later, but what are you going to do if you keep reading this book? Is it that easy to keep revising it, even in this era of, instant changes?
I don't know. I mean, I have one more opportunity, you know, when it goes into the paperback. And I think that opportunity will close out probably in the fall sometime because the paperback comes out in the spring. So I think the changes have to be done by the fall. So I only have a few.
Well, it's going to give some doctoral student someday
a
real field day.
They're so small, no one will ever even notice except for me.
How did you get started writing short stories? It's really not that easy a medium when you think about it because it does have to be fairly concise. But yes, it's short. You have that advantage. But you have to choose your pacing and your words carefully.
Yeah, I mean it utilizes a lot of narrative compression, but it's also an apprentice form. It's what teachers use to teach narrative writing to students because you don't want students embarked on novel writing at the age of 15, 16, 17, or even 19 and 20. You really just don't want that. So it's an apprentice form as well as a master's form. And so I do think short stories are assigned to read and to write, and that it in writers and maybe in some readers as well, the length and basically the MO of them, the shape of them, and the strategy of them becomes internalized through all that reading and writing. So that a short story feels easier to me in some ways. Although if you're a natural novelist and you like to spread out and you need the mess of a novel, I think a short story can feel hard. I had a teacher who felt that way. She was not a short story writer. She was a novelist, and she felt short stories were too hard.
What kind of prototypes did you have? I mean, there's so many different kinds of short stories, all the way, Guy de Maupassant or Poe or O. Henry, for that matter. But who are your models?
Oh, I don't know. You know, I read a lot of things that were published in the 70s, and so there was a sort of experimental bent still in many of those short stories. Ray Carver was publishing in the 70s, Ann Beatty in the 70s. They're not especially experimental, but they were doing things that had not been done before. The short story in America in the 60s, 70s, and 80s was really, really exciting. There were lots of journals, lots of magazines. People were reading them. People were writing them, doing very interesting things with them.
So, and then what?
And then a lot of magazines started to shut down. So there weren't places to publish anymore. The New Yorker used to publish two short stories every issue. Then it went down to, one maybe. Sometimes they don't publish any. Mostly they publish one story, an issue.
Why do you think that would be? Because, I mean, we're told, this shrinking attention span, so you would think that instead of reading novels, people would read short stories.
Yeah, I don't think the short story is about the shrinking attention span. I think a shrinking attention span works better with a novel because you can just stop anywhere you want when you're reading a novel and make dinner, answer the phone, you know, get dressed, whatever you want to do. But with a short story, you have to sit and read the entire thing from beginning to end in order for it to work. And people know that. And that, so it's not really for the shrinking attention span. It's for someone who has 45 minutes that are uninterrupted.
You seem to write a lot about grief in particular. Any particular reason for that, or is that oversimplifying?
I don't know. I'm old enough now and have enough. I don't have a lot of books, but I have eight. I can't decide whether that's a lot or little. But eventually, I think you end up writing about everything. So, I mean, I know there are some things I haven't written about, but grief is certainly, I mean, this most recent book is pretty much devoted to that idea. It's kind of a love story and a ghost story and a grief story.
I would say so from
Yeah,
from
I mean,
experience.
Grief is a big topic. Love is a big topic, and death is a big topic. I mean, it's hard to be a writer and not have those things emerge in your work somehow.
How about the autobiographical, though? There's a lot of confusion, it seems to me, has been over the years as to, well, this is Lori Moore writing, you know, her fictionalized autobiography, but... I seem to recall you saying on one occasion that's not really true, that a story would be very different if it had been autobiographical.
Oh, well, yeah, that's definitely true. It doesn't mean that there aren't autobiographical things in certain stories. And some stories are more autobiographical. They're leaning more on autobiographical energies than other stories. But, I mean, if you want to just look at, say, all right, now you've put this in front of me, the collection Birds of America. How could I personally, the author, be all these things? An unemployed actress, a woman in Iowa working for a test company, a dancer, a child of immigrants, I don't know. What else do we have here? We have a lawyer who is a judge. We have a gay man traveling with his gay lover. I mean, I couldn't possibly be all these things. So a certain amount of imagination is always required. And it's what makes it makes it interesting for an author to sort of venture out into unknown territory. One doesn't want to go so far and have your imagination fail you and then commit little errors. So you don't want to perhaps pretend to be, I don't know, a Sri Lankan warrior of the 17th century, unless...
Too big an assignment?
Well, unless you've done the research. You have to, you either have to have lived it, done some research, or you just have to know someone who knows a lot and then get it from them.
Is that really a large part of the fun, to just imagine life from somebody else's viewpoint, very different from your own?
Yes, it's tremendously fun, and any kind, it's very much like being an actor or an actress. I mean, and they'll tell you that. I mean, I remember watching Henry Fonda accept his Tony Award when, I think it was the Tony and not the Oscar, but he said he wanted to thank the award givers for, I guess he was getting an honorary lifetime award. For having allowed him his whole life to be other people besides himself. It's a tremendous source of pleasure and of knowledge, really, to be someone other than yourself.
He said another interesting thing, too, which kind of surprised me when I heard it, obviously, many years ago now. He said, that person up on the screen, that wasn't me.
Right. Right. Yeah. He was very alert to the, that's what happens when you embody a character, when you're performing a piece of art, you leave yourself behind somehow. And all artists do that to some extent, whether you're playing an instrument, playing music, you're leaving yourself behind, whether you're writing fiction or whether you're playing a part in a play or a film. You're entering some other form of existence.
I think Toni Morrison said something to the effect that when she looked back at some of the things she had written, she really didn't remember writing them.
Well, I'm sure that happens to every writer to some extent. She was a big one for saying, write about someone who is very different from you. And that's not a popular stand right now in literary discussions.
Really?
No, it's not. There's a lot of feeling that you have to stay within the boundaries of what you know deeply, and you shouldn't use your imagination to sort of leap over those boundaries. But if you do it, you know, I always say if you fail artistically, you'll be attacked politically. I've always said that, and it's more than ever true now, it seems to me. But it should not impede you from imaginative journeys. That's what we're all doing in reading and writing.
Do you think creating those other characters makes you more sympathetic in what I'll call real life?
That's what's always said. I like to think that. I don't see how it couldn't. But I also, I mean, you know, it's sort of like, well, does this herbal medicine work? could it hurt you? Probably not. So just try it.
What do you have to lose?
Right. What do you have to lose?
In I'm Homeless, If This Is Not My Home, some of this gift, I'll call it, for, and I will also call it satirizing, contemporary life comes through in some ways. It's kind of like, oh, yeah, I know exactly what you mean because I've thought this too.
Really?
I would say so, yeah. And perhaps
not in, about the moon landing.
Actually.
Actually, yes.
Well, that was one. And I wanted to hear you read a couple of passages pertaining to that. One of them just is a kind of, it's just a passing street scene. And it's when we find Finn walking through the streets of New York, and kind of a brief moment that he has.
The smell of the city in morning, the mix of food and smog, triggered in Finn the trips to strange cities he had taken as a child. He'd been made to be up too early with his school groups or his family, and now he could feel again the vague terror and strange adventure of a world happening simultaneously and separately from the world he was from. Cities seemed cobbled together from parts of other cities in other times. These days, people spoke loudly into their own cell phones. He recalled when he had first heard people doing this at the turn of the century, talking loudly in public on phones he couldn't see. He had been in disbelief. It was like everyone had willingly become insane. The disbelief times were now gone, but the voluntary insanity had remained.
I'm guessing, Lori, that walking through the streets of New York, you actually had that experience. Everybody gone nuts? They're talking to themselves.
Yes. Well, at the turn of the century, that was really how it looked and seemed. You know, people, you know, screaming into their phones. How can you do this to me? You know, things like having huge fights with people, and it was just so. I mean, now no one thinks anything of it. I'm reading an Ian McEwan novel that was right now that's written at the end of the 1990s, and he's got a lot of alarmist description of technology that's just beginning. You know, the idea that every phone, these original cell phones, had the last number you had called. Like, that was a new idea. And so that there was no privacy, and that, so that's registered there as an invasion into one's life, that you can't call secretly, and that no one can call you secretly. There's the number.
And you willingly give up to it.
Right, and that was just in the late 90s, and of course now here we are. Maybe we'll go backward. I mean, I suppose there's ways of blocking what number is calling. What's weird about cell phones, of course, is that it used to be with landlines, you knew where you were calling, and now with cell phones, the first question is, where are you? We don't know. So we've got more information, but also less information. We don't know where this person is.
Well, speaking of information, we don't always know if the, quote, information is accurate, as you also satirize in this same book, I'm Homeless If This Is Not My Home.
Maybe I'll just preface it by saying this is the protagonist who's visiting his dying brother and is just trying to sort of, you know, just keep him amused. But he's keeping him amused with you know, his various theories about how the official narrative on certain things has to be questioned. And that's really key to what happens in the entire novel, that this guy doesn't really buy the official narrative, whether it's about his girlfriend breaking up with him, his girlfriend dying, or the moon landing. He doesn't buy the official thing. He's looking around the corners of everything. But this is where he's talking to his brother, and he's just kind of going on a soliloquy here. And why did NASA send memos in December 1968 saying, help, we cannot make this tight political schedule. Apollo 1 had blown up right on the launch pad the year before. Humph, said his brother. As for the ostensible lone assassins, I say to my students, what are some reasons, do you think, that James Earl Jones got all the way to Canada and then to London, where he robbed a bank and a jewelry store when money he was waiting for didn't arrive, and then he got to Portugal? How was it that this assassin was on the lam for 65 days? Sponsored by somebody? You bet. The King family themselves don't believe a word the FBI ever said on the matter. And the man on the Lorraine Motel balcony holding King's head with a towel? A CIA plant. And the man taking the picture? An FBI one. Ray, said his brother. James Earl Ray, not Jones.
We're going to look further at this juxtaposition of contemporary life and humor and maybe even a touch of the macabre, too, as we look further into the latest novel by Lore Moore and get some further insights into writing from her. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with novelist and essayist and short story writer Lore Moore, and we've been delving almost inevitably into her latest book, her third novel, I Am Homeless If This Is Not My Home, which came out in 2023. It has gotten quite a number of interesting reactions, Lore. People don't know quite how to describe it, although they have certainly come up with some wonderful turns of phrase, as you do in the book. I almost get the idea that in some cases the reviewers are picking up on your style when they review the book, which would be kind of an interesting approach. But you have actually two styles in this book, because there are two stories that are interwoven, one of them contemporary, or actually 2016 at the time of that presidential election. Then the other one taking us back to, Reconstruction?
I would say it's 1870 or 71. I think there's some reference specifically that and if you do the math, it's 1870 or 71.
Which I won't say required you, but which you seem to have had a field day with picking up that 19th century style that a diarist might use in 1870.
Oh, I did some research and I read some diaries and I read letters and I let it all sort of, you know, percolate a little bit. And I don't, you know, I didn't use half the research I did. I know so much that just didn't get in there. For instance, if there's anything you want to know about John Wilkes Booth, I can tell you everything. But
Fascinating topic,
I guess. But usually when I say if there's anything you want to know about John Wilkes Booth, people go, no, I'm good.
I have an unending curiosity about
you
John.
Do?
I read his diary and, oh, yeah, seen his
Oh, well, you may know more than I.
Washington. No, I wouldn't say that. But I would say that it's endlessly fascinating topic for some people, and I'm one of them.
Yeah, okay. The whole Booth family is very weird.
It is. It is weird. And the fact that, for example, the young Robert Lincoln was saved from being run over by a train by Edwin Booth.
I don't believe that story.
You don't believe it?
No, I think that story was cooked up.
And it could have been. And that's, see, more false information, maybe.
I think it was cooked up to rehabilitate Edwin Booth, who was afraid that his career was forever besmirched by his brother, the assassin. So he had a guy who worked for him and did PR for him, was sort of his private secretary, also helped Grant with Grant's autobiography. I can't remember this guy's name. It starts with R.
But well, Mark Twain was involved in there, too.
Well, Mark Twain was the publisher, right, of Grant's biography. But there was a tremendous concern. Apparently, Robert Todd Lincoln was saved by someone, you know, pulled from a train that was coming in. And he later said that it looked a lot like Edwin Booth. But Edwin Booth was not even in town at that time that this happened. It was just an impossibility. But Booth's publicist, we'll call this person, ran with that story to make it, you know, because it's a pleasing story and it burnishes and helps rehabilitate Edwin Booth's reputation, which it needed.
Well, it did. Yes, right. As you can imagine, if your brother has assassinated the president, that your career on stage is going to be a little tricky.
All of theater was in danger, actually. Because it happened in a theater by actors. I mean, suddenly, you know, theater itself was in danger. And Edwin Booth was a businessman, and he owned a couple of theaters. He owned the Winter Garden and another theater. I can't remember which, but whatever. Okay. Sorry.
It's an irresistible sidebar there.
You can cut all that.
I hope not to. But let's get back to the style that you picked up here. Mm-hmm. And it's not just style. Of course, it has a bit of the Laurie Moore turn of phrase that spins it toward the comic in a very genteel way, despite what this woman is going to be doing later. For example, when she describes this new boarder that she has taken into her boarding house in this 19th century setting.
Yeah. Dapper as a finch, the handsome lodger can also recite the bewildering poems of Felicia Hemans, one of which features a virtuous heroine torn from home by pirates. Sweet Jesus, take the reins. His mustache is black and thick as a broom bristle, and the words come flying out from beneath it like the lines of a play in a theater on fire. He has an intriguing trunk of costumes in his closet, cotton tights, wool tights, a spellbinding number of tights, some wigs he combs out and puts on for amusement, and even some stuffing for a hunchback, which he portrays unnervingly and then lets the stuffing fall completely out. I don't know how he could manage a vigorous sword fight wearing those wigs. If I don't laugh, he puts it all away. He says he suffers stage fright everywhere but the stage. He says he will help me build a platform on the side of the house if I would like to get into wicked show business and put great joy into the hearts of simple men. I will certainly think about that, say I, and go about my chores. Why Miss Libby and Elizabeth should learn Elizabethan. Should she now? I do desire that we be better strangers. He is bold.
What made you come up with this idea of having these two interwoven narratives?
Well, I was interested in both narratives, and I thought they had things in common. And then I thought, well, one could be, I didn't want to write an historical novel, but I thought this character, Finn, is a history teacher. He might be interested in this aspect of history, and he could perhaps come across a document. See, so it begins really with a document that's in Finn's possession, Finn being the main character. So it's a little disorienting because it looks like it's the beginning of one novel, and then it starts with another novel. But it just begins with the document that is in the protagonist's possession. And, you know, there are narratives that have done that before.
Sure.
And people used to know how to read it without being so confused. But maybe those days are gone because there's been a lot of confusion.
One reviewer said it was like being a kid and having your hot dog taken away.
I know. I know. He should read more Alice Munro, since she begins with documents all the time. And Forrester did, and many people have.
Well, in the 19th century,
yes,
it was the standard to go back and forth from one.
Right.
I mean, look at Dickens. I mean, completely different character picking up, you know, Esther Summerson and telling her part of the story. Very different from what we got before. And I suppose it took a certain amount of patience to say, okay, we've just gotten to the climax of this story, and now we dropped it, and we've got to build up to another whole different climax in this story, and then they do gradually weave together. Although, I don't know how interwoven really are these two stories.
They're not interlocking, and maybe they're not even interwoven, but they have things in common. They're kind of together, commenting on each other a little bit, and they're kind of side by side, and there's some doubling, there's some echoing, but they're not keys to each other, so they don't really unlock each other, but they speak a little bit to each other, I think. I hope.
Well, I think you've also said something along the lines of don't be so literal when you read this book.
Did I say that?
I think so. Something to that
effect. Well, I've always said it's a weird book, and there may be some confusion. Some people have been confused, but then once they're unconfused, they totally get it. Other people just resent the slight confusion. So I don't know. Nothing I can do. This is just how the book came out. So, and then I became very stubborn about it.
There's another passage in here that, spoiler alert, but let's go there anyway, because I think that by the time people actually read the book and get to it, they will have forgotten perhaps what we've said here or what you've read. And that's where this boarder, this thespian, starts saying to his landlady, "Do I make you happy, Libby?"
"Do I make you happy, Libby?" he was murmuring, "because I want to more than anything. Every time I declaim my memorized Elizabethan poetry, I think of you." Instead of answering, I launched into a diagonal direction conversation-wise. "I will tell you a story that has some bearing," I said. "6 years ago, I had a bunch of Union soldiers here. Boys, just boys. Young and no trouble at all, not at all. They were happy that the war appeared over. A telegram had said that it was. And they came downstairs on Easter Sunday and sat down to breakfast. only to learn that the president had been shot in the back of the head in a theater. The president who had been their idol and their inspiration. Well, they pushed back their chairs and sobbed into their biscuits, inconsolable boys sobbing and heaving on Easter. It was a piercing thing. I will never forget it. I'm going to stop there. Is that okay?
That is just fine because, okay. Spoiler alert, sure. I mean, there is a plot to this book, and tempting as it is to go farther.
There are
right
things
there,
that happen. I can, you know, there are people who die, there are people who are killed, and there are people who come back to life. You know, yes. it's got a little bit of everything.
And let's look further at what some of that everything is in not just I am homeless if this is not my home, but some of the writing of Lori Moore in general when we return right after this for University of the Year. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Lori Moore, the short story writer and critic and essayist, and also, most recently, the author of the novel, her third novel, I Am Homeless If This Is Not My Home, published in 2023. And we've been touching from time to time on the intriguing premise behind this book, and that is that shadowy world between life and death, which you have moved into. I'm tempted, don't take this wrong, Lori, but I'm tempted to call this book kind of like Emily Dickinson meets Night of the Living Dead. Each has its, strong points, but I never would have put the two together. And yet they seem to fit, because what we have is a situation. And we've touched on grief before earlier in this conversation. We have a situation where grief is overshadowing the life of this man, Finn, in that his beloved, Lily, is no longer with us. Let's put it that way.
He's been told that she has died.
And again, what do you believe and what don't you believe?
But so he goes to visit her in the cemetery where
she's... This green cemetery.
The green cemetery where they bury you quickly.
And lo and behold.
Okay, so he's there and he hears a voice and he turns. There was Lily, standing in the dead fleabane, holding a large grapefruit like a globe, her shroud draped around her, a cocooning, filthy gown. She seemed to have emerged from a mist that still swirled about her feet. Beneath the shroud, she wore some institutional white pajamas, in her familiar stance, but at a list. Or had he cocked his own head? She appeared briefly off balance, waving like a lamprey or a balloon boy at a car dealership. She still had the proud, fabulous guesswork of a tree to match the rose-gold apple hue of her hair. Deliberate, undone, crazed death had not yet made a stranger of her. She smiled at him with a mouthful of dirt, her face still possessed of her particular radiant turbulence, yet watery, as if he were seeing not so much her face but its reflection in a pond. Her eyes were the dead bone buttons of a white dress shirt. Then suddenly color, their greenish-gray, washed into them. "What kept you?" she asked. He didn't say, as perhaps he should have, "My brother has been ill." "They did not stitch your shroud," he said instead. He looked over her shoulder, then back over his own to see if someone else were in on this. "Yes, something of an invitation. Can't ever resist an invitation. I guess I'm like a bad penny," she said. She brushed some bits of leaf from her hands, always turning up. He did not know what to say. He was mute with staring, too stunned to speak.
Your descriptions of Lily as she comes out of her grave there, and then as time goes by, in this story, this road trip is what it turns into between Finn and Lily. Your descriptions of her as she, let's say, progresses become so, well, they're beautiful, but they're also macabre, and they're very specific, very detailed. So I think that has left people wondering, is this whole story a metaphor or is it something else?
Well, it's a love story, and every love story needs an obstacle.
So you found one.
The obstacle here is death itself, but love will triumph. And I think perhaps there's some ambiguity. If you want there to be ambiguity, if you want it to be a symbol of Finn's determination to still have her be his and be in a relationship with her, have their love affair persist. I mean, there's different ways of interpreting it if you want to interpret. Otherwise, you just have to read what's on the page and just go with what's there. I think it's clear she's been buried, that she's not well. if she's completely dead, I mean, she says she's death adjacent.
Right.
So perhaps she is death adjacent, if we're going to take her word for it, which means she's close to death. She's a therapy clown, so she's been buried.
which is a really strange turn, I must say.
Right. My editor at one point was calling her a clown therapist. I said, well, that would be a therapist for clowns. I think she's a therapy clown. And so she's been buried in her clown shoes. So you have a corpse in a shroud with clown shoes on.
Well, in a way, you know, that's a symbol of the whole style of the book. Mm-hmm. Because you have this overwhelming grief and death and decay, and yet it's juxtaposed with something funny, a clown, and she's still wearing the oversized shoes.
Right. Well, you do bury people with things they did in their lives,
right,
and professionally meaningful things. And she clearly probably, well, who knows whether she was a very good therapy clown. She says she was not, because she couldn't really even save herself. But some people are good at things but with others and not good with themselves. So who knows? But this is all part of what could realistically be expected if she is indeed death adjacent and has emerged from this quickly dug grave.
So this does turn into a road trip.
It does.
And she does have a goal, something that she wants out of this
trip. She wants to go to a different cemetery. And to that extent, of course, it's an echo of Faulkner's As I Lay Dying, which I do have. I mean, I've used rather heavy-handedly here. I do have a little quote from it. But, of course, the mother in As I Lay Dying wants to be buried somewhere else, somewhere inconvenient. And so they take her there. And in this book, Lily wants to be buried at the Body Farm in Tennessee.
Speaking of epigrams, though, the one that you mentioned of Faulkner that you use from As I Lay Dying, the animal magnetism of a dead body makes the stress come slanting, so the seams and joints of a coffin are made on the level. But before that, speaking of juxtapositions, your first epigram in the series of three is from Stephen Foster. The buckwheat cake was in her mouth.
Yeah. I had a fourth epigraph, which was from Emerson. I just thought, well, that's just too much. I have to take the Emerson out. The Emerson was the only thing I've learned from grief is how shallow it is. And I thought, that's so subject to misinterpretation. I'm going to take it out. But and four is too many anyway.
But it would have fit beautifully in your idea because she is in a shallow grave.
You're exactly right. But
how, so where does the buckwheat
buckwheat cake is thought to be something that was put in corpses' mouths. Is that correct English? Put in the mouth of a corpse, buckwheat cake. So it's thought that this song is really about, you know, a woman has died. Oh, Susanna. And Susanna is the same name as Lily.
Is it?
In Hebrew. It's Shoshana, which means Lily. Hmm. So that's why that is there. Lots of games to be played here.
levels of meaning that
but epigraphs are always sort of tricky like that. But
Twain found them annoying, of course. He started putting them in hieroglyphics, you know, Egyptian hieroglyphics. It's because he thought they were so much people showing off, you know, with their Greek and Latin epigraphs.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I love epigraphs, but...
They're kind of old. Do people still do those? They almost seem a little old-fashioned.
Are they old-fashioned? I don't think so. I see them almost in every book I read, but I'm trying to think what I used in Birds of America. Maybe nothing, because they were stories.
Yeah, it was a collection.
I did. I had Charlie Smith's The Meaning of Birds and then another bird poem by Amy Clampett. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you ever feel that you're competing with yourself?
No. It depends what you mean by that. I would like to be one of these review people who say I never read my reviews, but I do read the reviews because I also am a book reviewer, and so I'm interested in how people go about reviewing books. And I would not have wanted to review this book; it would be very hard. So I appreciate people who've gone in and really tried to grapple with it because it's hard. But I have noticed that there is this easy way out in reviewing a book where you just you take the writer's older books and say, well, those were much better, which is very unhelpful to sort of make a writer compete against their prior writings. But it may be inevitable, but it may be inevitable, but it's not necessary. But that's exactly what I mean. So there's a bit of that where your older work is held against you. If the newer work doesn't sit with the reviewer for whatever reason, but, you know, it's very hard to review books. I appreciate any kind of effort, but I don't quite like the giving up and tossing the book across the room, saying, ugh, it's not a patch on the other stuff. So some books are in competition with each other, but not in my mind, just, you know, in perhaps a reviewer's mind. A writer has to think all their best books are in the future.
And that their best book is the one they're working on.
Absolutely. That everything, that you're going to get better every time. And I sort of think I feel the same way right now. I mean, I feel, you know, that I've got more things ahead and they're going to be good, or as good as I can make them.
Novels?
I would like to have another novel. You know, I mean, I'm starting to get old, but, you know, we'll see. I would also like to go back to stories. So, I mean, I do have other work ahead.
And when you say you have other work ahead, you're saying you have other work in your head?
Yeah. Well, I spent the winter and spring in Berlin and doing a little bit of loose research there for some things. And so I whatever I have next will have a little bit of Berlin in it.
That'll be a departure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Advantages, disadvantages of teaching, which you do a fair amount of, including, of course, some major authors that are familiar to us today. Lauren Groff, for one.
Yeah, Lauren, Emma Straub, Vedic Fafana. I mean, I have so many great students who've gone on to publish. They're really just taking over the world. It's like really amazing to me. When I can make a very, very, very long list of people who've published fantastic things. And you know, I keep getting new things in the mail. There's a student of mine, Alina Grabowski, who is having a book out next year, and she sent me a galley. And I'm like, yes, so great.
Can you see yourself in any of those books?
See myself?
In terms of what you've taught them?
No. No, but you don't know how teaching is processed. You know, you don't. The only thing you hope you can see is that you encourage them, and that you didn't discourage them. I have to say, even there are people who I was even not that encouraging of, who then switched genres and became like brilliant essayists. There are a couple of people here in Wisconsin who are now two of the most brilliant essayists in America, I think. And they started as fiction writers, but they had to make their way through fiction writing classes to get to where they needed to be. And that's really all you're doing as a teacher. You're just helping them stay on the road.
You've been at Vanderbilt for a while now.
Yeah, about 10 years.
In a southern setting other than the alter narrative in this book,
I have the works, Lori Moore? I have the South right here. someone asked me, would I have written this book if I hadn't moved to Nashville? And it's probably true. I probably wouldn't have. But I would have written something else, you know, but it wouldn't have had the South in it quite the way this does.
Maybe picking up some Southern cadences in your
writing? Sure. I hope there are some here.
There definitely are some there. I just thought going forward
there would be more. You know, I have two grandfathers who were Southerners. So when I was growing up, my parents would tell us we were half Southern.
In New York State.
My grandfathers were not from New York State. They were both from North Carolina. One of my grandfathers I never met, but the other grandfather did not speak with a Southern accent, but he would say y'all in a Northern accent.
It's a wonderful all-purpose word.
It's a great word. It's a great word.
We've had some great words with Lori Moore, too, getting some insights into her latest book, her novel, I'm Homeless, If This Is Not My Home, published in 2023, and also getting some insights into her life and writing along the way. Always a pleasure.
Oh, well, thank you all for having me.
I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you all join me next time around for University of the Air.